And men go abroad to admire the heights of mountains, the mighty waves of the sea, the broad tides of rivers, the compass of the ocean, and the circuits of the stars, wrote St. Augustine of Hippo in his Confession. Yet they pass over the mystery of themselves without a thought. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and this is the fourth lecture in Wyoming Catholic College's distance learning course, Into the Lenten Desert, Learning to Pray with the Medieval Masters, taught by Dr. Jason Baxter. In the Confession, Augustine explores how for years he passed over the mystery of his own self until he began actively exploring that mystery. Why do we behave as we do? What is the appeal of sin? What's the appeal of holiness? Why are we so restless? What is truth? In this lecture, Dr. Baxter explores Augustine's restless heart and the inward turn, what Augustine learned from the pagans.
As we saw in the previous lecture, the ancients were convinced that we're born into this world, as it were, as orphans. Deep down inside, we have a fundamental orientation toward the good, but we've forgotten our Father. Augustine believed this too, but with a very important difference. That one, or good, for Augustine, is a person, who, unlike Plotinus's one, made us for himself, and to this end continues to seek us as we wander in the barren desert away from him, what Augustine called the regio dissimilitudinis, the region of unlikeness. Everywhere where God is not. Augustine describes this great drama wherein God seeks us out most masterfully in his Confessions. If for Plato we're awakened for the upward ascent through love, and for Plotinus through beauty, in Confessions we find something new, the experience of weariness, soul fatigue, and restlessness. And desolation can nudge us to look higher too. And in his Confessions, Augustine, the man who spent the first 3 decades of his life doing little else but mastering the subtleties of language, leans into this feeling, summoning all the power of his language to create a literary portrait, like some great Rembrandt of words, of the restlessness of our hearts, wherein we wander through this world apart from God. Throughout this literary masterpiece, again and again, the late antique professor of rhetoric magically evokes this sense of heaviness. Sometimes we feel like we're pouring ourselves out uselessly. I had spilt out my soul upon the sand, says Augustine. Sometimes we feel like we're walking through dark and slippery places, having gone out of ourselves in the search for the God of our heart. Sometimes we feel like we've wasted the better part of our days in frenetic activity, and this has left us interiorly depleted, indeed cut and wounded in the soul. We feel fragmented, torn asunder, or tossed about and wasted and poured out and boiling over. At his most powerful, Augustine describes the soul in this region of unlikeness, wandering over the face of the world, looking for a place to incarnate. Quote, I bore my soul all broken and bleeding and loathing to be borne by me, says Augustine, and I could find nowhere to set it down to rest, not in shady groves, nor in mirth and music, nor in perfumed gardens, nor in formal banquets, nor in the delights of bedroom and bed, not in books, nor in poetry could it find peace. I hated all things. I hated the very light itself, and all that was not he was painful and wearisome, save only my tears. In this way, Augustine says, quote, I became a great enigma to myself, and I was forever asking my soul why it was so sad and why it disquieted me so sorely, and my soul knew not what to answer me, end quote. This restlessness is a fundamental concept in Confessions. Is the unavoidable desolation that comes from committing the ur-sin of cupidity, that primal sin of metaphysical forgetfulness, when we forget that all creatures do not have their own beauty, but only a borrowed beauty, as Plotinus put it. The technical Augustinian term for this is cupiditas, but at one point in Confessions, Augustine calls it more colloquially, immoderate inclination. Quote, this life we live here below has its own attractiveness, yet in the enjoyment of all such things we commit sin if through immoderate inclination to them, for they are good, they are of the lowest order of good, Things higher and better are forgotten, even you, O Lord. End quote. And if you live in this condition of having turned your back on God, and then having forgotten he's behind you, you'll be cranky and irritable and restless and angry and fragmented, bearing around with you your tired, lacerated soul. You seek fulfillment, constantly expecting that it's on the horizon, but it keeps moving back farther away as you approach it. Like some modern artist or director, then, Augustine gives us a landscape of bleak desolation. In short, Augustine is a master of describing the Christ-haunted self, which looks everywhere in this world for happiness, but finds bitterness and disappointment mixed into those things we had put so much hope in obtaining. But the extraordinary thing, though, is that God has an active hand in, quote, mingling bitterness with the sweet, which brings us back to him from poison of pleasure that first drew us away from him, end quote. The soul fatigue is one of the healing instruments of the God who is hunting us, even when we are lost. As I've said, for the ancients, the one is awe-inspiring and beautiful and moving. But it's not personal. If you get a glimpse of Plato's hyper-Uranian plane, your soul will be filled with warmth for a whole year as you treasure the memory within. But their good dwells abstractly, distantly, in its infinite beauty, indifferent, beyond, indeed ignorant of our existence, like Tuscany, which just dwells there in its beauty, unaware of whether you're actively photographing it or just remembering it now back home, far away. But Augustine's God is different. He's a maker, sustainer, seeker, lover. And because of this, the Christian orator has to develop a new register of language, a kind of spellbinding, dreamlike, enchanting, musical language that no one had ever heard before. The brilliance of Confessions, then, is that Augustine doesn't just philosophize. He speaks the second person singular to God, using the you form. And he creates a hypnotic spell by developing a style which expresses a sense of intimacy and presence. If Plato is like some kind of musicologist you admire who makes you grow in admiration for your favorite composer by drawing your attention to the patterns and structures of a symphony, Augustine's the musician who performs it, who performs the presence of God. Great art thou, O Lord, and worthy to be praised, and man desires to praise thee. He's but a tiny part of all thou hast created. He bears about him his mortality, the evidence of his sinfulness, and the evidence that thou dost resist the proud. Yet this tiny part of all thou hast created desires to praise thee. Thou dost so excite him that to praise thee is his joy. For thou hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless till they rest in thee. This desire to address God, as if he were present to me, now, within, is what keeps Augustine's Confessions from being an ordinary autobiography. Indeed, if you're reading Augustine as if he were writing a simple tell-all, you'll be disappointed. He keeps interrupting himself with theological digressions or lyrical moments of praise, and just as he's getting to the juicy bits you were hoping for. We have to understand that the autobiographical bits, then, exist in this context of practicing the presence of God. Augustine's chief purpose is not to relate simple information. Rather, it's a hunt for the hidden God, hidden within his past life, within his memory. I'll explain. Augustine doesn't imagine his growth as on a line moving from the left to the right, but as a series of onion layers, in which new layers are added, but earlier stages are still there within me, so to speak. And so Augustine walks back into his imagination, peeling back the layers of his development in order to find the God that who was there, even if Augustine at the time had not known it. The most dramatic moment of divine presence that Augustine was totally ignorant of comes in the example of infancy. Infants learn to speak without being taught how. They know how to suckle without any prompting. The mother's breasts, he adds, are full of milk without volition. Already then God was nearer to me before I even had the rational power to recognize it. Augustine tries to push it back even further. And before that, O God of my joy, was I anywhere? Was I anyone? By walking all the way back into that time which is now buried in the darkness of the forgotten, well beyond the borders of his rational faculty, Augustine bumps into God, who was always already there. Yet all the time, you were more inward than the most inward place of my heart, and loftier than the highest. Infancy, then, is an important theme for Augustine, in part because it was that liminal stage in which the human heart found itself wanting to interact with its parents, both to express its needs and its contentment, but did not yet have the words to draw out those desires. And so the infant struggles, cooing, flailing, doing its best to pour out its little heart. And in other words, yet deprived of words, the infant is forced to try to tap into a language deeper than words. If I use a word you do not know, I can use a second word to clarify it. And if you don't know that word, I can use a third word to clarify the second. But if you know no words, how can I say anything to you at all? What the infant's parents intend, then, must become clear by what he says, a kind of natural language, common to all races, which consists in facial expressions, glances of the eye, gestures, and the tones by which the voice expresses the mind's state, end quote. But fascinatingly, this interest in gesture and expression and wordless communication comes back, later in Confessions, in a passage devoted to loss and love. Even in adult friendships, we express things from our hearts. We give affection and receive it back, shown by face, by voice, by the eyes, and a thousand other pleasing ways, kindle a flame which fuses our very souls, and out of many makes us one. When we keep all this background in mind, we notice that this effortless language of love, of flashing eyes and beating heart, is the most proper language of prayer. But though I knew it not, says Augustine, you were listening. And when in silence I sought so vehemently the voiceless contritions of my soul were strong cries to your mercy. You knew that I was suffering, and no man knew it. For how little it was that my tongue uttered of it in the ears of even my closest friends. Could they hear the tumult of my soul, for whose utterance no time or voice of mine would have been sufficient? Yet into your hearing came all that I cried forth in the anguish of my heart, and my desire in your sight, and the light of my eyes shone not for me. End quote. Elsewhere, Augustine refers to the Word of God, made flesh, so that your wisdom by which you created all things might give suck to our soul's infancy. Putting all these strands together, we can see that we have an extraordinary modification of the ancient idea of going within to find God. By going back into the darkness of his own past, Augustine can, as it were, return to that period of his life in which God was present within him, but he was yet absent from God. He can go back and find God in his infancy, and retroactively become present to the one whom he had ignored. Augustine can use all the powers of the outer layer of his rational adulthood, his eloquence, his rationality, to return to nearness and holy neediness of the inner infant. Indeed, the God who made us nourishes us. In a prayer too deep for words, a prayer more akin to the infant's needy nursing. And if it's somewhat startling for us to think about prayer in this way, we have to remember how shocked Augustine's contemporaries would have been. The Confessions, then, are an attempt to walk back into the darkness of his own life, discover with regret how his God was there, even if he was still absent from him, and then utter a cry of voiceless contrition from his soul's depths to the one who has always already been there. In light of this, any borrowing from the books of the Platonist, as he calls them in Confession 7, will be complicated, multi-layered. Without question, Augustine drew much from the Platonist, but he also reworked everything within a Christian context. For example, Plotinus had used the Odyssean image of a man who cannot get home. Augustine borrows it, but reworks it within the context of the prodigal son. Quote, "To be darkened in heart is to be far from thy face. It's not at our feet or by some movement in space that we go from thee or return to thee. Thy prodigal son did not charter horses or chariots or ships or fly with wings or journey on his 2 feet to that far country." End quote. And similarly, we can find new layers when he borrows the motif of the ladder of love or the climbing up of the stairs. In Book 7, Augustine describes his first moment of spiritual breakthrough since he read Cicero's Hortensius, a treatise now lost as a teenager. "The moment came from reading the books of the Platonist," he says. And this was his reaction. Being admonished by all this to return to myself, I entered into my own depths with you as guide. And I was able to do it because you were my helper. I entered with the eye of my soul, such as it was, and I saw your unchangeable light shining over that same eye of my soul, over my mind. It was not the light of every day that the eye of the flesh can see, nor some greater light of the same order, such as might be if the brightness of our daily light should be shining with a more intense brightness and filling all things with its greatness. In this way, the Libri Platonici, the books of the Platonist, help Augustine have a breakthrough moment, in which for the first time in his life, the invisible light of God began to feel more real, seem more dense, and have more meaning than carnal realities had had throughout his life. He was finally able to get a glimpse of that mysterious invisible world, of intelligible light, to see and perceive and feel it as something of weight and substance. The Platonic authors then had taught Augustine that the way up was to enter into his own depths and wake up a different faculty of knowing. And sometimes Augustine calls this mysterious faculty the eye of the soul. Elsewhere, he calls it the ear of the heart. But all of this is massively Platonic. Just a few passages later, in another difficult but utterly fascinating passage, Augustine gives us a couple more tantalizing details about how this mystical vision came about. I marveled to find that at last I loved you and not some phantasm instead of you. Yet I did not stably enjoy my God, but was ravished to you by your beauty, yet soon was torn away from you, again by my own weight. I was altogether certain that your invisible things are clearly seen from the creation of the world, being understood by the things that are made. So too are your everlasting power and your Godhead. I was now studying the ground of my admiration for the beauty of bodies, whether celestial or of earth. Inquiring then what was the source of my judgment when I did so judge, I had discovered the immutable and true eternity of truth above my changing mind. Thus by stages I passed from bodies to the soul, and from this to the soul's inner power, and from there I passed on to the reasoning power to which is referred for judgment what is received from the body's senses. This too realized that it was mutable in men, and rose to its own understanding. It withdrew my thought from its habitual way, abstracting from the confused crowds of phantasms, that it might find what light suffused it, when with utter certainty it cried aloud that the immutable was to be preferred to the mutable. Thus in the thrust of a trembling glance my mind arrived at that which is. Then indeed I saw clearly your invisible things which are understood by the things that are made. But I lacked the strength to hold my gaze fixed, and my weakness was beaten back again, so that I returned to my old habits, bearing nothing with me but a memory of delight and a desire as for something which I caught the fragrance, but which I had not yet the strength to eat. Again, we can feel how Platonic Augustine is. He ascends by going within, and he does so by stages of ascent. Think of the steps on the ladder of love. He moves from bodies to soul to the inner power of reasoning. But when he comes to the height of his contemplation, in the thrust of a trembling glance, his mind arrives at that which is. And all this reminds us of Plato. In short, his contemplative trajectory goes from traces of God in the visible world to a perception of those invisible things themselves, as the two quotations from Romans 1:20 that bookend this passage make clear. But this comparison to the Platonic tradition also helps us see how Augustine's story departs from the Platonic account in important ways. First of all, whereas Plato posited as the penultimate step of ascent, the great sea of beauty, where gazing upon this, he gives birth to many gloriously beautiful ideas and theories. Augustine contemplates his own mind. In other words, Augustine is enamored not so much with some invisible realm of forms, which he doesn't seem to believe in, but rather with the very capacity of the human mind to find truth. Later on in Confessions, Augustine marvels at the astonishing capacity of his mind, not only for what it can store, but what it can range through at an instant. Even later, in On the Trinity, Augustine famously develops an elaborate understanding of an inner trinity within us. That is, an infinitely subtle psychological collaboration between our will, intellect, and memory, necessary in any use of our mind. Thus, Augustine throughout his life returned to the mind, its operation, its deep structures, and even more abstrusely, its very ability to recognize the light of truth when encountered, such as the eureka moment of solving a geometrical proposition. There is then an inner light, a light of the mind which stands in analogy to the intelligible light enveloping God. Augustine's personality-based, psychologically driven inner exploration turns out to be even more interior than Plotinus's. The second important difference that emerges is that for Augustine, the failure of the intellectual ascent can become the beginning of prayer because it sparks the desire of our hearts. The soul's inability to launch itself all the way up to God can bring about the birth of a longing, a new affective desire for God. Toward the end of his first description of the Platonic ascent, Augustine concluded, "Thou art my God, I sigh to thee by day and night. When first I knew thee, thou didst lift me up so that I might see that there was something to see, but that I was not yet the man to see it. And thou didst beat back the weakness of my gaze, blazing upon me too strongly, and I was shaken with love and with dread. And I knew I was far from thee in that region of unlikeness, as if I heard thy voice from on high. I am the food of grown men. Grow, and you shall eat me, and you shall not change me into yourself as bodily food, but into me you shall be changed." Plotinus, too, had understood that at the first moment of revelation, the vision might be too bright for the soul. But Augustine understands that it's God who will provide him that nourishment to make him a spiritually grown man. A process of nourishment, as we have seen, described as nursing an infant. We're certainly no longer in the world of Plotinus. When Augustine's intellectual ascent falters and his soul flutters back down, he has to beg and plead. In other words, Augustine's intellectual ascent culminates in an effective, heartfelt prayer. And when I cling to God like an infant to its mother, I'm nourished in prayer. The intellectual ascent sublimates in the darkness of pure love. Thus, Augustine's ascent has a new layer of descent. It's not just that you have to go within, but that we have to humble ourselves, stoop low in imitation of Jesus Christ. This, of course, is where the Platonic ascent breaks down for Augustine. There's a huge difference between the Platonist and the Christian. Or as Augustine put it, "I had begun to discern that there's a difference between presumption and confession, between those who see what the goal is but do not see the way, and those who see the way which leads to the country of blessedness, which we are meant not only to perceive, but to dwell in." The problem is that the Platonists don't know anything about this second kind of descent. They know a lot about the lofty and the mighty and the strong and the ambitious. In Augustine's words, they wear the high boots of their sublimer doctrine. For this reason, they have contempt for anything about God's descent in the incarnation, about how the first principle or one became flesh, and thus nothing about confession, humility, and tears. In other words, they know nothing about infancy. But the God who nourishes us in prayer, who was once also a baby wailing, stretching forth his limbs, and trying to make himself understood, does. "The writings of the Platonist," says Augustine, "contain nothing of all this. Their pages show nothing of the face of that love, the tears of confession, your sacrifice, an afflicted spirit, a contrite and humble heart, the salvation of your people. And we hear no voice calling, 'Come unto me, all you that labor.' They scorn to learn from him because he is meek and humble of heart." Then Augustine concludes, "It's one thing to see the land of peace from a wooded mountaintop, yet not find the way to it and struggle hopelessly far away from the way. But it's quite another thing to hold to that way that leads there."
While St. Augustine sought to probe mysteries and to understand, part of the mystic tradition is to do just the opposite, to live with the mysteries, and indeed to plunge into the darkness to discover the light on the other side. Join us next week As Dr. Baxter discusses Dionysus the Areopagite and the darkness of God. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.